Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
Hello, and welcome to the Creative Series Globally Speaking podcast. I'm Stuart Davison, Creative Director at RWS, and I'm excited to be joined today by some of my brilliant colleagues from Small World Studio. Sinky Jitter, Head of Client Services and Operations, James Marshall, Creative Director, and Silvia Sanchez-Fernandez, also Creative Director. Now, before we dive into the conversation, let me quickly introduce Small World Studio. Small World Studio are a passionate team of creative and production specialists here at RWS, partnering with agencies and brands to deliver global campaigns and marketing communications that truly connect. Their work is all about amplifying content across every channel and market, ensuring it resonates with local audiences through culture-led consultation, local storytelling, and seamless end-to-end creative and production services. Let's get started. Suki, I know you just come back from Cannes Lions. Let's start there and hear how it all went and what your key takeaways were.
Thank you, Stuart. Yeah, we've recently got back from Cannes. It was a great opportunity, I guess, to connect with clients, reconnect with some of our clients, meet other like-minded creatives and just really understand what's going on in the industry, what everybody's talking about, which actually Silvia and Jim. Silvia, what were your main takeouts from Cannes this year?
There were a few, but I think if we bring it to my terrain, I want to talk about the importance of the storytelling for brands. This was something that featured very heavily in our panel, and it's something that we have been talking about for a while now, and it's how can brands be global but still relevant in talking to their global audiences. So that was a thread that was very present throughout the many conferences and chats and events that we attended, and is very, very much linked to us. This is our heartland, so very pleased to see that we're very relevant in that playing field.
Yeah, it's very pivotal at this time, isn't it, really, for us and obviously the industry. How about you, Jim?
I think I agree with Silvia. Very, very positive, enlightening. I think for me it was really good. Obviously, AI has taken over every conversation of every event I've been to. I think from a creative standpoint, culture, there was some agencies that seemed to be the importance of realigning, repositioning values and core kind of competencies and where they sit in that and that cultural connection around where they connect as a team, the strengths and skill sets that they offer, and really the value that strategy and creative plays in amongst what even at Cannes this year I think was quite a tech-driven, certainly along the beach, tech-driven event. But yeah, I think positivity, and not that it's humans versus machines, but I think a genuine positivity and the value that still creative has to bring, in collaboration with technology and AI.
Thanks, Jim. So I just want to take it right back to the beginning, and I'm really keen to understand what inspired you guys to get into the creative industry in the first place, and how did you start and why did you start? So maybe Stuart, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think for me, initially, it was probably one of the only subjects that I felt comfortable with. I loved English. I loved English language and literature. I wasn't that good at it, but I loved it. But I really enjoyed the art piece. So, you know, back in the day, my friends and I used to make comic books, and I used to be the sort of the sketcher of those type of things. And that sort of led into this sort of, I guess, the graphic side of things for me and the passion to sort of... pen and pencil ideas rapidly. And then as I went through, A-levels to foundation year to university, you get to explore more with that and you get introduced to other things like photography, fashion, and all these other aspects of the creative field. And it just inspired me to continue that further. And as sort of my knowledge sort of, I guess, broadened, I think my passion for it, you know, increased as well. And then the introduction of, I guess, all the software that's available now has kind of also piqued my interest, in, you know, in regards to how we can use all these things that, generally speaking, would take me a while to be more creative, more efficient. I mean, that's kind of where I've landed.
Jim, well, how about you?
Well, I suppose being a Gen X, growing up in the Midlands, born in London, but growing up in the Midlands in the late, you know, mid-70s, obviously it wasn't the easiest kind of subject to broach with your friends. It was always kind of like, can't you study for a real job? But I think, like Stuart, I think art was the one thing I've always been interested in. I think, like many things, I've got my mum to thank for that. She was the creative one. Unlike my dad and my brother, they went down the engineering route, which was never going to be me. And also the classic kind of slightly dyslexic creative. But yeah, always interested in mixed kind of media, always interested in model making, always doodling. It's something I've kind of grew up with and found it kind of stress relieving as well when I was young. But yeah, kind of left school to pursue A-levels on a ground course specifically so I could experience, I suppose, what we call mixed media now, but photography, filmmaking, ceramics, metalwork, model making. And I didn't know until even the end of foundation what I wanted to specialise in, which ended up being graphics and photography. Photography, something I still, as you know, have a real passion for, documentary photography. But yeah, maybe it's Jack of all, master of none, but I think it did give me great, great preparation to what became, you know, a mix across digital production, traditional creative. So it kind of built me into what I am now. But yeah, very much foundation and then onto my degree and specialised in photography.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's really interesting to know, you know, what a taboo it was in when we were all growing up, but actually how the creative industry now, it's thriving and, you know, young people are just so keen and passionate to get into the industry, which is brilliant.
I think you get a wider exposure to it now. Like I kind of, there's definite similarities between James and I, because I come from an engineering family background, like generations of engineers, and I was the first one to do sort of the creative field, and there was always a concern that I was never going to make anything of it. But that foundation year, you know, at college really makes a difference. Some, you know, we talk about photography just a minute ago, just understanding how a camera works, how to work the darkroom, that's information you don't lose, and you end up still using it, just more in a technical sense of in Photoshop, to sort of, rather than doing it in those environments, you're using it there. But it's knowledge of how to take those pictures as well, and where, you know, where to crop and all this type of thing. It's that exposure to a broad range of things.
And it's funny because my mum, poor mum and dad, I think I broke them, which I'm going through now in my daughter's college. But I think I spent hundreds of pounds building dodge and burn tools in the darkroom to kind of literally, traditionally, you know, analog, spend hours getting my negatives to print correctly. I'd phone them up, you know, from a telephone box, obviously, and kind of say, I need some more photography paper. Because,
and,
you know,
always smell, been a perfectionist. And the smell in the clothes that never leaves, does it, the developer?
So, yeah, come from a very traditional background, but, you know, still good to look back at that because people don't realise, you know, the basics around that. But I think the good thing about today and courses today, not only are, you know, Gen Zs and the people younger, they're native to obviously a lot of the technologies and processes. I think the courses are far more in industry set up. I think that's the one negative thing from my side. I don't know about you, Stu, but my course was brilliant regarding, you know, getting to know your true mediums and understanding technically what you're doing. But regarding jobs and industry based, I had to go back to square one when I went into a job. But yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There was none of that sort of, what does this mean if you go down that path? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there's a few of my friends who are photographers and they're now designers, but they started off having that dream of being a photographer, but the expense of setting yourself up was quite a lot. So they ended up transitioning more into the design field because that was, again, a little bit more accessible, I think. But yeah, you're right. You know, that's the business sort of sense as to what, you know, if you're going to take this and go out on your own, whatever you're going to do, how do you get going on it?
Sylvia, how about you? How did you get into the industry?
Perhaps a little later. I mean, my household was a creative household. My dad was a craftsman. There was always paint and white cork and wood and things like that at home. My mom was a seamstress, but creativity was actually not cherished and championed. They lived through a dictatorship. So they thought that the better to pursue in life were things like, you know, law or medicine or business. So we were never really championed to pursue a creative career. But when I moved to London when I was 18, I mean, London was the place where I realized that, you know, I met people from all walks of life. Differences were cherished and you know, people were accepted by their differences. And I fell at home immediately. And although, you know, that melting pot of cultures, the languages, at that point, I'm like, I want to study something creative. And that has to do with communications. And that's what I did. I went to uni and I studied communications. And that was just the beginning of the rest of the last 20 odd years. So, yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Let's just jump into some of the other questions. So global content obviously needs to resonate, and especially at that local level. And that's so key. That's everything we heard about at Cannes as well this year. And obviously it's the focus of Small World Studio here at RWS. Can you share any stories where that local insight was so important and it really made a difference to the brand or to the campaign that you guys were working on? And how do you think it really impacts creativity and especially when you're trying to launch something at scale, how do you think it impacts that?
I can take that if you want. So I remember a few years ago, we were working for a very, very large and well-known global sportswear brand. And they were gonna launch a campaign that was quite it was huge at the time. They were like the pioneers of the toting shoes, if you may remember them. You know, while you walked, you turned different parts of your body. The brand was the headquarters was in America. The agency was in Europe. So they came up with this amazing campaign that was very much focused around women's butts, bottoms. And because that was the kind of like the beauty standard at the time was that you wanted to have a toned bottom. Obviously this was going to be a global campaign. They had one set of master creatives to go globally. And when we started talking to markets and we kind of like brought in those local market insights, that's when we started realizing that this was not going to fly in lots of places. In South America, they wanted bigger bats. in Asia and APAC, you know, the butt was not so revered. It was more like, you know, the back of the leg, you know, the quads and perhaps the calves. So they had to quickly go back to the drawing room and come up with four different sets of master assets that were really truthful to those areas to really kind of like represent the type of woman that would be cherished and actually sought after in those areas. And that was key to the campaign then landing in all the different regions and being a little bit more meaningful. That's something that someone in Europe thought about that then was not in America for an American brand that wasn't really going to feel representative. And obviously we also brought in a more diverse cast to represent all those different geographies, cultures and markets. So that's one example of it.
So interesting how beauty standards change wherever you are across the world and actually how campaigns and brands have to reflect that, really.
Absolutely.
Jim, how about you?
I think there's two, really. One stood out because it was, I mean, Sylvia was, I think, part of that at the time, but and it's quite old, but it was the first global huge campaign for a huge tech company. We were very much a partner. And it was the first campaign, really, where the big idea and the strategy was a great idea, but very much had to be locally nuanced around playgrounds. And I think it was the first instance where a lot of the time we'd seen kind of localization being, you know, something quite strict. And there's your content, localize the words, maybe change the picture. But I think it was the first instance where we had quite big local teams, and we engaged with client early on in that process. And I think by doing that with markets and being inclusive of the markets, with the main idea from the agency and the main, I suppose, kit of parts, we're allowed to generate and build each market set of content, and very much different content. And at the time, quite huge digital campaigns, what they call Big Bang takeovers, so station takeovers with mixed content of out-of-home posters, digital signposting, escalator panels, but a real true sense of how do we take this idea and amplify it and make it work for that market. So we did some brilliant big campaigns locally that fitted in, obviously, with that agency and that client's needs. So that was one. Another one was probably my favourite job ever, which I was very much a part of, which was for a big luxury hotel brand. And it was it wasn't really a campaign. It was direct, and we had to look at a film and some content photography to celebrate the diversity of the hotels, which were all around Europe, the culture, the history, the heritage, but kind of really weighted in the universal service pillars and values of the brand. So we kind of engaged with the brand, and then we obviously looked at recceing each hotel, found local producers, but we then got local heroes that worked sometimes for 30, 40 years in these hotels. And we're talking Beverly Hills, we're talking Rome, we're talking all some luxury locations, which I had the real privilege of meeting some quite famous people as I was wandering through sweating with my camera. But those insights on the culture and the history and heritage from those local insiders were critical to then weave in, obviously, those values from the brand. And we created a celebratory kind of Alice in Wonderland film that combined all the hotels, weaving in and out of doorways. Then we did individual hotels and then shot photography for social for all of the hotels individually, which could then self-propagate with some of that audience. So a really lovely example, but not going out and using our own staff locally, but really engaging with local specialists that lived and breathed it. And it was critical, really, to get that balance.
And sounds very glamorous at the same time.
It was.
And Stuart, you've recently relaunched RWS as a brand. And did you have to take into account local insights as you were, you know, considering the new brand and all the brand devices and the language that you use in the tone of voice? What sort of work did you guys have to do when you launched RWS as a relaunch?
Yeah, there was a few aspects, actually. What was the first part was we obviously engaged with Small World Studios and sort of put some of our messaging out there. I know Brit helped us with this because, you know, it makes very good sense what we're proposing from our perspective. But then when you deploy it in other areas, especially APAC, they want more context around this. And we had to really tell the story so that these messages or this proposition we're putting across can resonate in those areas. You know, so having that knowledge and that capability internally was a great, you know, resource for us. But we've also used it with our marketing colleagues in APAC as well, where they've sort of informed us and educated us on how we deploy these messages in areas like events. So we, generally speaking, in America, UK, we would have very sort of low context, you know, marketing messages that are geared to draw people in. But when you go to the, you know, APAC, they want to know exactly what you're talking about up front. They want to be able to understand that from a distance before they even engage with you. So how we're using those messages is completely different. It might be quite like a what we call a well-designed, nicely engineered booth from a Western perspective. But when we go to APAC, there's a lot more content on that booth. You know, they we're literally listing things out because that's their requirements for them to sort of feel comfortable working with us and talking to us. I think we're a little bit more, was it, open to risk in Western cultures. You know, we'll put things out there and, you know, hopefully someone picks up whatever that is, whereas in the East, they want more, less risk. They want to know exactly what you're on about and what you're offering.
Can you share an example of a project where balancing the global brand consistency with local nuances was especially challenging?
It's an online accommodation booking brand, They were launching a campaign that was first done in America with a very American sort of like brand tone of voice that was not really going to resonate in Europe. But to add to the to the challenge, this was COVID, so we had to balance ever changing COVID, COVID regulations, requirements, and basically situations in various countries in Europe, with a master that came from America, working with global clients, regional clients, local clients, checking the news every 5 seconds to make sure that what we were going to end up putting out there was relevant, and also doing a lot of work ourselves. And Jim can talk to this, as to try to get those locations, that imagery, those videos, that feeling for that place, and in the context of what was happening COVID-wise at that particular time, and really timing the on-air time of the films with the latest, the latest news and updates on COVID. So that was particularly challenging. I mean, obviously this was not your usual thing. I mean, you don't get COVID every day, but it was a very good example of how, a globally mandated campaign that had to be anyway heavily nuanced for different countries in Europe, with the challenges that presents, and then add to that a layer of COVID regulations and ever-changing environments. And it required working very closely with global, regional, local teams, and as the kind of like the gel and the glue between them, and ensuring that we had the latest, the latest information and news from every country, and that we had the relevant footage and imagery that would go with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jim, you worked really hard on that one.
Yeah, I've got to thank that brand, really, because it was from a time where we couldn't even go out except maybe on our bikes. So I kind of felt like I travelled around Europe for a few years. I think the challenges were, it was, and without mentioning the brand name, it was playing on the humour, lighter-hearted side of lockdown and the changes within it very cleverly. And we had to art direct from stock footage, which was an ever-changing list of places that were locked down, weren't locked down, but choose the right style of art direction, the right beauty shots, and even the right kind of camera moves. And we had to pre-plan that. So we had to give choice because it was always changing. So myself and the team would first recce lots of locations within a region, both for style of video and obviously location, but also have bear in mind the master edit and understand the order of those different places, and again how that voiceover and that playful tone and nature of that would play out. So quite tricky, but really rewarding, and as I say, it felt like I was getting out of the house quite a bit, which was great.
It was interesting as well, because we even had to kind of like change the scripts as we were moving along, because that feeling from the first master asset of like when people couldn't get out in some countries in Europe that were a lot more laid back about regulations, that was not the case. So we had to even sometimes change the script as the situation in a country was changing to make it sound relevant to that particular country. So perhaps it was not so evocative of when you couldn't leave the house. It was perhaps more evocative when you couldn't do long distance travel, but you could still travel within the country. So all of those changes were, they just require a lot of collaboration, but we pulled through, came out really well.
How do you work with content when it's not just about the translation piece, but more about emotional resonance and cultural connection? How do you approach, I guess, that from a creative problem solving point of view, maybe when the global messaging isn't going to work in terms of the local realities of what's going on there? Is there anything that you can give our audience in terms of best practice, I guess?
Engage with the right production agency from the very beginning. I mean, we just keep saying this. I mean, if you wait until you have your campaign, your master campaign signed off, it's very likely that you're going to encounter a lot of these issues, and then they're a lot more time and cost effective to fix. If you bring us at the very beginning of the creative life cycle, we will be able to troubleshoot from the beginning. There's something that we talked about at Cannes, and that is very relevant, culture-led brands, what are those? And those are brands that have their audiences at the center of what they do. And they have an ongoing conversation that feels relevant, that feels authentic, where audiences end up advocating for that brand, defending it, etc. That you get to that point if you start at the very beginning with a global mindset and you engage with the right people who can give you the right amount, well, not the right amount, but the information around culture and cultural insights that you will need to build a campaign from the ground up, taking into account all of your global audiences and all of the nuances that you'll have to deal with as you develop that campaign. Start at the very beginning with real-time cultural insights that come from people who live and breathe that culture. And then your campaign will be, and your creative strategy will be totally culture-proof and language-proof.
I was going to say, like, I agree with Sylvia, like, you know, talking to experts is the agency first thing you should do. Like, you wouldn't go into another industry without talking to someone who knows that industry, right? So it's the same with global content and local content. You need to talk to someone that understands that so that you can tailor your messaging and test it correctly so that you get bigger impact. And it's almost like it's box tick number one, right? You always do that.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, totally. And I think brands have moved on. I think we still see it from time to time, but, you know, there's never enough time to do a job, but there's enough time to change it at the wrong stage of a process. And I think getting in as early as possible and being more inclusive, I think, with markets. I think culture, I mean, it's now intersects so many different things from, you know, the core values of an idea and a brand, you know, emotive, you know, I think there's some human truths, feelings, opinions, but I think regarding culture, it intersects politics, tech, a lot of things that change and are very different locally. And I think you have to engage and celebrate locally prior to really determining what your output's going to be or your kind of production slate. So, yeah, I think trusting those markets and the experts locally and the audience, you know, I think that's the key, really.
How much leeway do you have for testing messages or content? Like, do you have to sort of really make sure you nail that down 100% before it goes out? Or can you go, let's just try a couple of things here and see which one resonates the most?
I guess we work with a lot of agencies and brands when they're doing their testing and getting involved in focus groups. We'll often support them through that process. So as they're going to take something out to testing, we'll be part of that process, really, to make sure that, you know, there's a few options there so they can actually get a really good varied viewpoint from that focus group. And how does that then test and land in different markets? And then we'll take those insights with the agency, with the brand, to then, I guess, make the creative work harder where it needs to be, really.
I think it's never that black and white. It's always subjective. There are clear no-nos, clear areas to avoid, but the nuances and the complexity, I suppose, around that connection and what that could combine, I think we can validate what would work and what should work, but I think there has to be some ambiguity in there. But Sylvia, I'll let you probably completely disagree with that answer I've given.
If a brand was really on constant conversation with the audiences, I mean, you know, testing should not be, you know, shouldn't be, you know, such a deal breaker, because you should know better where the conversation should go. But it is true that that's not the case often. So I think testing can be a very good thing in certain instances, but it shouldn't become too constrictive to the initial creative concept. I mean, sometimes it's good to be disruptive with your own brand. You know, you put a creative strategy in place, you do creative development, and then when you test, sometimes you get something different. Well, maybe sometimes you should push for that difference, you know, because that might create, you know, a more interesting conversation. I think brands sometimes, with their testing, they're just too concerned about, you know, pleasing a lot of people. And or pleasing a large amount of people. And is that what you really want? Is that making your brand different or disruptive? I mean, Bob Marley used to say you can please some people sometimes, but you can't please all the people all the time. And I think that's a good thing. Yeah. I think it's a great methodology, but it shouldn't be too restrictive to the initial creative idea, especially if it was based and founded on a good global strategy with global insights. So yeah, that's my take. And I think sometimes brands have tried to push themselves onto people too much instead of, like, you know, helping, you know, having the right conversations so people actually want to come to your brand and you don't have to be pushing towards them. And then when you have people coming to your brand because you're helping them solve a problem or, I don't know, with a service, a product, with something, that's when you create that reciprocity that makes brands really relevant. I think a lot of brands have a long way to get there. But when you get there, then you become an iconic brand, I think.
But I think consumers want brands that feel authentic to them and has the same value system. So if a brand can reflect that, actually that's what's going to draw audiences, especially today with younger consumers. You know, they want to feel that the brand understands them. So it's not just a cultural relevancy, it's actually understanding, like, what they stand for and what their value system is, which I think is so important.
I think brands like TikTok, I think from being a search engine through to actual purchase, and the way obviously influencers and social content is just driving brands, and they're jumping on obviously social events and cultural events, and that's what's building a lot of brand equity and trust and being truly authentic, those conversations that are being built around the audience instead of a brand telling an audience what they should hear or want to hear. That it's the other way around.
Absolutely.
Let's jump into that hot topic of AI, shall we? So AI is changing, obviously, the creative landscape, and it's changing it really fast, as we know. Jim, you said at Cannes, that's what everybody was talking about, and all the other events that we've been going to. How have your teams had to adapt to the creative process to bring in AI? And where do you think that humans are obviously still part of that process and not going to not ever be part of that process? I'm going to go to Stuart first, actually.
Yeah, we've been, I guess, using AI for quite a while. Like we've had a couple of people in the team that have been really quite on it. You know, so we've been on quite a long journey with it. So we've had it quite well integrated into our workflows now, especially in design and video. It's really become somewhat of an enabler. Like we can spit out some pretty decent concepts for ad campaigns now quite rapidly. And that's the concept stage. So that, you know, rather than having, you know, pretty, I guess, sketchy drawings, we can almost get quite close to where the end result's going to be. You know, we're spending more time on the idea, so that content is getting produced and turned over, you know, a lot quicker, which means that, you know, we're getting things out. It's more relevant when we are able to get it out. And it's, you know, there's always that efficiency part that I have to look at within the team. But I think rather than efficiency, I call it an enabler. Like it's that tool that's in our toolbox now enables us to be more efficient, you know, enables us to have more enjoyment out of the job because we can do more. You know, the imagination can take you so far, then it comes down to skill, but that can actually help us get it that little bit further. You know, you can actually visualize or quickly write what we want or turn something into moving images, you know, how we want it. So we can start with, you know, something quite raw and go pretty high end quite quickly. Like I said, it's been a boon for us. You know, it really is. I don't, you know, I look back on a few years ago about how we used to do things and I'm like, I don't know how we do without it these days. It's been an excellent enabler.
Brilliant. Jim?
Yeah, I think there was a panel, and at the end it was obviously another conversation of AI, which is great. But at the end, it's are you positive, are you negative? And my hand went up for positive, then my hand went up for negative. I started doing a little dance. I suppose I've got a foot in both camps. I think it's brilliant. You know, it's out of the box. It's revolutionary. And I've been around for a lot of these cyclical kind of, you know, true innovative technology changing landscapes and involved in some brilliant projects where I suppose even the advent of the web and some great kind of digital publishing projects at the time that felt revolutionary now don't. But it was a balance between, I suppose, a good friction between creative and tech. And, you know, I kind of see the same with AI, but it's far bigger. But I think I'm kind of treating it as one of the cast of the job. You know, I think your job and your workflows and processes, it's how you utilise them and how you use your specialist skill sets. I think AI across, like no other, I think, before, end to end, can revolutionise the way you work. But I think also there's a massive, you know, I tread with intrepidation because I suppose the photographer in me, I remember doing my dissertation at a college on the manipulation of the computer image back in analog days. But yeah, I've moved on from that and I'm obviously fully using. But I think this is different. And I think the overused term human in the loop for pre and post editing, directing, you know, directing with prompts is key, and it shouldn't replace the craft and aesthetic we've got, but it should enhance, allow you to spend more time on the value areas of what we as humans do and the connection, the authenticity, and getting somewhere quicker, like you said. I mean, the brainstorming, prototyping, the, I suppose, analytics and data to a degree, again, as long as they're validated by humans and added to, these are all things that are baked in, I think, to everyone's lives in our industry now already. It's only going to get bigger. I think, you know, everyone's developing tools or using industry kind of leading tools that will no doubt change, swap out. But I think it's how we integrate that into our workflows and into our kind of interfaces. So it's a smooth process. And yeah, as I say, both camps. And I think that friction and that uncertainty and untrust won't change for me. But I love it. And I'm also nervous at the same time. But yeah, we're using it. The team are using it. I think trying to hang your hat on one technology across automation or production, we've obviously at RWS, we've got some great innovative tools, but there's so many different areas of focus, some changing. So I think it's allowing that flex and being agile and really looking at what you need out of a job and what tools will work through that process, in conjunction with, you know, craft and skills that we've all got and we don't want to lose and certainly don't want to change.
Great. How about you, Sylvia?
I mean, I think, you know, people need to understand, that's what we all want to believe, that, you know, AI is a great collaborator, but it's not a creator, at least not when you're thinking about top of the funnel, you know, brand campaigns. If we're talking about advertising, that human creativity, nuance, emotion, that's very much ours. Lower funnel, you know, activations, campaigns, etc., that would benefit a lot more from more automated AI-driven processes.
As you know, we're all working with, partnering and working on projects within platforms of some of the biggest tech creative softwares and brands out there, utilising their tools, building, you know, customer-focused content. And they're brilliant, but like Sylvia said, I think they're for certain types of projects, certain types of work. It's brilliant. So I think knowing where to use it, how to use it is key.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you don't want it to be too obvious either, right? I think you mentioned it, Jim, authenticity, right?
Yeah.
For me, that's really important. This, if you overuse AI, you lose that. I think it becomes quite samey and, you know, at top of the funnel type of content or, you know, above the line, you really want that authenticity as a brand.
You know, there's less noise. You know, everyone can pump hundreds of ads out, social content, but, you know, we should be combining this. So we've really got a blended way to get some really good kind of tactile creative out there using, you know, AI and human and creative and innovation.
Great. Just wrapping up with one last question. So any brand, if they're looking to go global, what one piece of advice would you give them and wish that they would know when they're going through this journey? Sylvia, start with you.
I think I'm going to repeat myself. Engage with the right agencies from the very beginning.
I think we talk about connection and authenticity and culture. And I think be more inclusive earlier on, both with your local markets, which from experience over the years, I think just not sharing something early enough with certain markets, I'm not going to mention which ones, can automatically build barriers. And I think by being inclusive earlier, and also sharing that early with the experts, local experts, creatives, designers, strategists, copywriters, I think the earlier the better.
Yeah, mine's not a piece of advice, but I'm just going to reiterate a coined term that I think you guys came up with, which was global is the start point. Right, I think that's a really nice sentiment. You know, just start there and you can't go wrong. So it's not advice, but it's a good term to use, a good reminder.
Global is the start point, not the afterthought. Yes.
Not the afterthought. So thanks, guys. It was really great chatting with you. And thanks, Suki, for being the co-host on this one. It's been nice to actually be involved in the conversation for once and actually being asked the question. So I really appreciate that. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to get.